Welcome back to the Poor Proles Almanac. This is Andy. Today we're joined by Dr. Gerald Horn, a historian, writer, podcaster, and activist. Dr. Gerald Horn is a John Jay and Rebecca Moores Professor of African American History at the University of Houston and has written over 40 books, each fundamentally challenging conventional history's narratives. His research has addressed issues of racism in a variety of relations involving labor, politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. He is the author of several books, including his latest, Revolting Capital, Racism and Radicalism in Washington, D.C., as well as Armed Struggle. Arguably one of the most important historians in my lifetime, it was an honor to discuss his most recent books and the evolution of our current political arena. If you're wondering where we go from here, this episode's for you. Now, if you're interested in hearing Dr. Horn talk more, check out his own podcast and grab his books listed in the show notes below. And now let's jump in. Dr. Horn, thanks so much for coming on. First off, I'm a huge fan of your work. I've read a number of your books. One of the things I particularly appreciate is how thoroughly cited and clear you make a lot of your arguments that, you know, I went to school for history and I felt like I was reading a different history, which is just wild to think. And I think that speaks to the complexity of the way our historical narrative has been constructed. And that's something we'll talk about a little bit. But I want to start before we even get into the book. What really sparked your interest to write about your most recent book around Washington, D.C.?
Well, actually, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because my most recent book in the last few days is Armed Struggle, Panthers and Communists, Black Nationalists and Liberals in Southern California through the 60s and 70s. And if you crack open that book, available at better bookstores everywhere, you'll find that unlike some of my other books, I'm part of the story. I first visited Berkeley in 1969. I attended a Panther anti-fascism conference in neighboring North Oakland. Arriving in San Francisco in 1970, I got immersed in Panther activity. I was teaching at a prison in Northern California, where I encountered the man then known as Donald DeFries, later as Cinque. He went down in flames in 1974 as a leader of the so-called Symbionese Liberation Army. I, in fact, had lent him my prized copy of Frederick Engels, The Origins of the Family, Private Property in the State. Of course, never got it back, which is a lesson with regard to lending out books. So that's my most recent book. And the DC book was last year. And what got me interested in Washington, of course, is that it's the center of power. Ironically, it's the center of power that intermittently has had a Black majority. And that struck me as somewhat contradictory. And I think it struck the authorities as somewhat contradictory, too, which is why the grim reaper of gentrification is rearing its ugly head in the nation's capital. And so that book traces Washington from 1900 to 2000, looking at the rise and fall of the organized left, the rise of Black nationalism. And interestingly enough, my 2025 book will be Slavery's Capital, Racism and Radicalism in Washington, D.C. through 1865. In other words, it's dealing with the slavery question. And I'm going to start off the book with an event of maximum importance taking place just across the Potomac River in what is now West Virginia, then Western Virginia, when John Brown, the heroic John Brown and his hardy band, tried to liberate the enslaved at Harper's Ferry. And one of the first prisoners they take is a lineal descendant of founding father George Washington, who's taken prisoner by one of John Brown's Black comrades, who is groveling and sniveling and begging for his life. So I thought that that would be an intriguing way to begin that particular book.
Yeah, that's an interesting story. It kind of reminds me of Denmark Vesey's, his son coming back after, I believe it's a civil war, to the church that was burned down. And he ended up being an architect who oversaw the rebuilding of the church in Charleston, which is just like this fascinating, like unique story that you couldn't have written this. It's too perfect, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'd heard about your new book. I didn't think it had come out yet. I thought it was due sometime this year, but I must have missed the window on that. So I must have checked that out. I've heard you talk quite a bit about it. I was going to ask you a few questions about it and how that had been going. Because you do talk a bit about Black Panthers, as you mentioned, and that the narrative around the Black Panthers is a little bit messier than I think we give it credit today. That especially I think on the left, where we see this as like, here's how we should organize because it was successful. And that is stripping it of a lot of the reality of struggle and the reality of like trying to organize and operate under capitalism, right? It's not as simple as social media or any of these kind of broad strokes kind of discussions around like organizing and making material change in neighborhoods and communities likes to sometimes paint it. So I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that book before we get into some of the other stuff.
Well, that particular book, Armed Struggle, ties into some of my previous books, because part of what I'm arguing in the Armed Struggle book is that one of the reasons why the Panthers found it necessary to pick up the gun was because implicitly, not necessarily explicitly, but implicitly, they did not accept this idea that the founding of the United States in 1776 was this great leap forward for humanity. Implicitly, they adopted a position that I eventually memorialized in one of my books, particularly the Counter-Revolution of 1776, that is to say that 1776 operated at least on two tracks. On one track were the indigenous, and I'm not even sure if liberals or conservatives today in the United States would argue that the indigenous were a beneficiary of 1776 since they lost their land, their territory, et cetera. And then, of course, there was the other victim of 1776, the enslaved population. Although some seek to throw dust in our eyes by convincing us that 1776 was abolitionist, this was strange abolitionism indeed, since the number of enslaved grew exponentially by 1860 to 1861, from thousands to millions. And if that's abolitionism, I hate to see pro-slavery in action. And then, of course, when you look at states like Vermont, for example, which touts the point that supposedly it sought to ban slavery in the 1770s. Well, actually, like Oregon in the 1850s, they sought to ban all Negroes, free or enslaved. Now, you can call that anti-slavery and try to deceive people into thinking it's the same as abolitionism. But fortunately, many of us know better. And so when the Panthers found it necessary to pick up the gun, they were reacting to the horrid conditions that Black people were being subjected to, not least in the Golden State, where the LAPD, the Los Angeles Police Department, is still running amok. I tell a story about Palm Springs, just east of Los Angeles, now a haven for aging movie stars, formerly a residence of both Frank Sinatra and Gerald Ford. And that happened in part because the Black community in Palm Springs was burned out. I mean, literally. I mean, one topic that's a sub-theme of this book is the question of fire. And of course, it's a throwback to my book from the 1990s, Fire This Time, The Watts Uprising in the 1960s, where fire is coming from the other side of the barricades. But fire in this book is coming to burn out Black families, oftentimes leaving them literally in ashes, not to mention their homes. So this particular book, in many ways, speaking of the latest book, Armed Struggle, is a culmination of various historical projects that I've been working on for decades.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, the scope of work you've done is just surreal. Frankly, if you do an Amazon search for any of your work, it's just the amount of content you've covered that I feel like is very difficult to find anywhere else is just, it's amazing. And I think it points to a way to comprehensively understand the conditions we're in today seeing that it's the summer of 2024 and we are staring down an election that feels surreal, to be frank, right? That, like, I think everyone collectively is just wondering how did we end up here, right? Like, you know, regardless of your politics, everyone is thinking, you know, if you're on either party, how did that guy win the other party? And then if you're on the outside, how did anyone pick these two people? When you start to put it into a historical context, it does make a little bit more sense. So I really do want to get your thoughts about where we are and kind of what does the trajectory look like in the next 6 months and further?
Well, I'd like to be the bearer of good news, but I'm afraid that that's not the case, particularly given the recent Supreme Court decision on presidential immunity, where the right-wing majority on the high court seeks to immunize what they think is the incoming president, speaking of Mr. Trump, and as Justice Sotomayor put it in her dissent, allowing him to send Navy SEALs to assassinate political opponents and not facing the hammer of the law. And I do not think that's an exaggeration, because a close reader, or perhaps even a not so close reader of a lot of my work, I think would understand how we arrived at what I consider to be a classic counter-revolutionary moment. I find it in some ways a natural outgrowth of 1776. For example, my 2026 book will be The Counter-Revolution of 1893, The Hawaii Coup and the Roots of U.S. Imperialism in Asia and the Pacific. And therein, one of the subjects I tackle, in addition to the Hawaii coup, of course, is the opening shot, in some ways, of U.S. imperialism, setting aside the attack on Native American nations on the mainland, that is to say, the invasion of the Philippines. And what's interesting there is that the avatars of that invasion were Republicans. Republicans, of course, were also the party of Lincoln, and those few Black people who could vote, voted for this party of imperialism. The Democrats, look at William Jennings Bryan, for example, could style themselves as being the anti-imperialist party. But in some ways, they were just updating Vermont and Portland, insofar as they thought there were enough dark-skinned people under the U.S. flag, and therefore there was not a need to have Filipinos under the U.S. flag, even as the colonized. But as we also know, the Democratic Party at that particular moment had an armed wing called the Ku Klux Klan. And so what's happened in recent decades is that the historic roles of these parties have flipped. The Republicans under Mr. Trump are the party of neo-fascism. They're the party that is threatening, as one of its initial acts, a draconian crackdown on immigrants, which, if it takes place, will inflict a wound on this economy, given the labor that they're engaged in this country. And it will not assuage the Trump base, which will then lead to ever harsher measures and a downward spiral. Whereas the Democrats, once the party of the Ku Klux Klan, are now the party of foreign invasions. Gaza, for example, being the threats in the South China Sea, for example, be it Korea under Harry S. Truman, 1950 to 1953, or Vietnam under LBJ in the 1960s. And then that puts the Black voter in a contradiction, because the Black voter says, we'll vote to block fascism. That's the idea. But they're also voting for neo-imperialism, which is contradictory to the Black community's long-term goals, because as my work has shown, one of the major reasons we were able to escape enslavement was because of opposition, for example, to the attempt to overthrow the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804. The persistence of that revolution ignited a general crisis of the entire slave system that could only be resolved with its collapse, including in North America, per 1865. Followed by Jim Crow, and then in the 1950s, the United States found it difficult to win hearts and minds as Africa and the Caribbean were coming to independence. And as Governor Earl Warren, the architect of the internment of Japanese Americans in the 1940s as California governor, puts it, as Supreme Court Justice in 1954, Chief Justice in 1954, the United States had to basically appeal to global sentiment by taking agonizing and halting steps away from Jim Crow, which of course leads to a right-wing movement to impeach Earl Warren, and then leads to, once again, a counter-revolution to reverse the Warren Court's more liberal decisions, which is how we wound up where we are today with this six-headed monster majority on the U.S. Supreme Court. So once again, I think, to reiterate, that even a casual reader of the works I've done, have written and published, will not necessarily be shocked nor surprised by this turn of events in 2024. And once again, I would like to be the bearer of good news, and I will lift the gloom and doom to an extent. I feel obligated to do so because I also do interviews on the Pacifica station in Los Angeles, KPFK. I find them to be quite inspiring because I pick and choose who I interview. And there's tremendous work being done, either in terms of historical scholarship, in terms of activism, for example. You can't explain why there has been this counter reaction in Florida and in Texas with regard to crackdowns on school librarians and attempting to reconfigure the teaching of Black history in Florida by Governor DeSantis suggesting that actually the enslaved learned skills during enslavement. You can't understand this sort of nonsense unless you understand what he's pushing back against. And what he's pushing back against is this tremendous work that's being done in this country, which in some ways is heartening because, once again, if you look at the international situation, despite the election in the European Parliament, which saw the rise of neo-fascists and the recent election in France, ditto, at the same time, we're on the verge of seeing the Tories turned out in London. If you look at the European parliamentary elections in the Netherlands, Labour and the Greens did quite well, despite the fact that they have an Islamophobic regime in power. So all is not gloom and doom. But on the other hand, let's not be a Pollyanna and try to put lipstick on the pig, as they say in the United States of America.
Hey, we're taking a quick break in the episode to remind you that you can get a whole lot more information from poorproles.com. On our website, we have access to our supplemental reader for the podcast, which provides more depth and context, as well as thorough citations for all of the stuff we talk about in the show. You can also sign up for our newsletter, which updates you about limited releases, such as various nursery stock that we sometimes sell through the Poor Proles website, as well as updates about new merch that we have. You can also support the show through that website, poorproles.com, where you have access to our Patreon and our Substack to get early releases for articles and episodes. Now, if you enjoy the show and are just looking for even more audio content, go check out Tomorrow Today, which just wrapped up season one, or tune into The Gastropocene, which is a project of myself and Dr. Aisha Khan to discuss the way our diets have driven the Anthropocene and what it looks like to use our diets for good. Now, back to the show. I guess, like, within this context, for the last 8 years, we have done the sky is falling, right? The last decade. Since Trump took politics seriously, like, a lot of people on the left are like, yeah, this is this natural decadence of the two-party system, so on and so forth. How do you envision the next 2 or 4 years going? Like, what are we looking at in your thoughts?
It's hard to say. As I said, it's 50-50. It can go either way. A part of the problem, I would say, in the Black community, which has been a specialty of mine, is that the mass organization, the NAACP, found it necessary in order to garner anti-Jim Crow concessions in the 1950s to throw their internationalist wing overboard, which makes it difficult for the NAACP to campaign against foreign adventures, for example, which means making it difficult to campaign against the Pentagon budget, for example. And that is a real problem, and I don't see necessarily a way out. And I think it also contributes to this magical thinking that's becoming so prevalent. Many of our liberal friends, in light of the Supreme Court decision, they say, oh, I know what we need to do. We need to change the Constitution. Like, you can just change the Constitution just like that? I'm going, they're lawyers. They should know that it's been made intentionally difficult to change, which is why there have only been, what, 27, 28 different amendments? Some countries have more than that in a decade, for example. Or they'll say, oh, we need to have term limits for Supreme Court justices. Well, don't they know about the filibuster rule, for example? And if they want to overthrow the filibuster, have they thought about the Republicans retaking the Senate in November of 2024? Or they'll talk about other sorts of measures that are totally unrealistic, given the correlation of forces. And given the correlation of forces, what we actually need, of course, is the labor movement, which was another victim of the Red Scare, to begin to rediscover its internationalist roots, which were once quite prevalent, and then be able to fund a mass movement, oftentimes involving knocking on doors in contested neighborhoods and having heart-to-heart talks. Because one of the many virtues of this campus encampment movement that swept across the United States in the spring of 2024 is that it helped to introduce the term settler colonialism into our vocabulary. Now, of course, it's being applied to historic Palestine. Some have applied it to Southern Africa, Zimbabwe, South Africa. Fewer still have applied it to North America, sadly and tragically. And in fact, a couple of professors put out a book a few years ago, a compendium on settler colonialism, where they discuss these other cases, but they don't even discuss the United States of America, believe it or not. I mean, it's quite shocking. It's malfeasance and misfeasance of the highest order. And one of the reasons is that settler colonialism oftentimes involves class collaboration. Now, you have those who refer to themselves proudly as class reductionists, but they obviously don't understand the question of settler colonialism and class collaboration. That is to say, as I pointed out in my book on the 16th century, when London sent settlers into what they called North Carolina in the 1580s, they were from various class backgrounds, sponsored by the 1% in London. And it's not as if settlers got off the boat and said, you know what, I think we're going to join the Native Americans in fighting it back against the settlers. No, that's worse than a fantasy. Oftentimes, of course, they fell in with the status quo. Speaking of the status quo, you know, in my Texas book, I talked about the sad case of the Cherokee, who in the first few decades of the 19th century began to assimilate, owning enslaved Africans, engaging in sedentary agriculture, addressing sartorially like the settlers, converting to Christianity. Yet, they still had to go and embark on the Trail of Tears. And of course, you had many European settlers just off the boat who move into their mansions. And so when Mr. Trump talks about make America great again, he's rather vague. But I think that his base absorbs the message that some of them really didn't mind those, what some of us would call the bad old days, when there was a gross and impetuous privileging of whiteness, for example. Now, of course, there is this counter-revolution against diversity, equity, and inclusion, but that's only creating more contradictions for the U.S. economy, because one of the reasons why that particular movement took flight was because capital, amongst others, felt that there needed to be a more efficient deployment of talent, particularly by drawing upon the untapped talents of women of various ancestries. But there was an article in the Financial Times of London just a day or two ago that talked about the rebuke of DEI, which some of the detractors have applied the descriptor, didn't earn it with regard to women who are now climbing the ladder of success. And so it leads to an ill-considered deployment of talent. And in the long run, what it means is that there's a contradiction of capitalism, because the bulk of the population does not have the skills to propel a complex economy, and oftentimes, because being pushed down the socioeconomic ladder, not having the capital to consume what's being produced. And so that's part of the contradiction of the US economy, and part of the contradiction of this counter-revolutionary moment that we're now facing, which, if we're not careful, could lead to even more severe consequences than we're now contemplating.
Yeah. As you were talking, I was thinking a little bit about before the Civil War, a lot of Southern plantation owners were talking about that they were going out of business, that the labor force was too large for productivity, and that they weren't able to produce at an affordable or cheap enough rate. And I feel like there are some weird parallels where we've gotten to a point where so many people are in the labor force, and there's always this fear under that there isn't enough work for people, right? And that maybe this is a way of stripping back and allowing like predominantly white men to reinforce their place as labor is overabundant. And obviously there's a class dynamic component of that where white working class, white collar workers in particular, these specialized workers can fill those roles while there's a redundancy of menial labor because of the fact that we have technology today and that we're starting to see some of those same dynamics kind of play out. I'm curious if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, my mind reels back instantly to what's going to befall undocumented workers as of January 2025, if the polls are correct and Mr. Trump returns to the Oval Office. If you noticed in the debate, he was cruelly evasive. Every question was turned into deportation. Childcare, deport the immigrants. Fentanyl, opioids, deport the immigrants. U.S. foreign policy, deport the immigrants. If he carries through with that, once again, it's going to be severely wounding to the economy, not to mention wounding to the families and the breadwinners involved. It's going to complicate relations tremendously with the neighbors of the United States, Mexico in the first instance. And of course, Mr. Trump has his eyes on Mexico because he sees it in some ways as a front for the People's Republic of China. Just recently, it was announced that the major port in the United States of America today is Laredo, Texas, not Los Angeles, Long Beach, not New York, New Jersey, but Laredo, Texas. And to the extent that that's accurate, it has everything to do with China seeking to evade and avoid tariffs and other crackdowns by moving into Mexico and exporting from there. And this has not fooled the orange man one bit, one iota, one scintilla. And so on the one hand, I feel torn in terms of this conversation. I feel compelled to try to introduce these grim scenarios. But at the same time, I feel it's my obligation to paint the other side of the picture. The other side of the picture, of course, being the fight back against this sort of arising neo-fascism and the organizing that's taking place in various workplaces, what the United Auto Workers has been able to accomplish under Sean Fain, for example. So I guess all I can do is say that there's a race and there's a 50-50 chance that our team will prevail.
It's confident that you're saying our team. Going back to your initial point about the dichotomy of the two-party system, God, I wish I could say something insightful, but it just feels so depressing.
Mm-hmm. I understand.
We've kind of gotten caught up in the current era, which is fine, but I did want to talk a little bit about some of your book work. Specifically in the book Revolting Capital, you talk a little bit about the 1940s, which is kind of my specialty area in history. And I also think this has a lot of parallels with modern times. You write about Henry Wallace, who I'm a very big nerd about because he was a farmer. He was very tied into like some very progressive farming ideas that ended up FDR supported until the war, and then everything kind of fell apart. But he's a really interesting guy. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about him and kind of his significance and what happened to him. To me, what I see in his story is a lot of parallels to like the Bernie Sanders of 2016. Mm. Or 2020, rather. I'm curious if you have similar thoughts or not.
Well, of course. And sadly, this will probably be the last point that I address, although feel free to invite me back for round two. Henry A. Wallace was a giant, continued to believe that one of the most disastrous personnel movements to be grandiose about in the history of the world took place in 1944 when FDR was prevailed upon to release him from his duties as U.S. vice president and replacing him with the former haberdasher from Kansas City, speaking of Harry S. Truman. The Cold War might have not been as disastrous. It may not have even taken place. The Red Scare would not have been as disastrous. It might not have even taken place. And it's really tragic, the fact that that personnel move, I'm afraid to say, was supported by some people who really should have known better. But once again, that's 2020 hindsight. And once again, I look forward to returning to your podcast.
Yeah, I will put up the links for all of your books or your two recent books. And again, you want to reiterate your show, so if people want to listen to you chat more.
Oh, yeah. Well, all of, including this interview, will be found on the Activist News Network on YouTube. And the interviews I do for KPFK, the Pacifica station in Los Angeles, can be found on their website, also at the Activist News Network. I've been doing two interviews a week for 3 or 4 years.
That's a heck of a schedule.
Yeah, and I learn a lot. That's one of the reasons why I do it. Just last week, I was talking to the scholar who's done this path-breaking research on slavery and arson, which seems intuitive that the enslaved, particularly enslaved women, would use fire to strike back. But he finds, you know, the enslaved trying to set fire to the Confederate White House, trying to set fire to George Washington's widow, Martha. When Thomas Jefferson speaks of a fire bell in the night, he was not just issuing a metaphor. He was speaking of something that was repetitive in Monticello and in Virginia. So check out those interviews. And you can learn right along with me.
Awesome. Dr. Horn, this has been fantastic. So happy to have had you on. I'll definitely be in touch. And just thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me.